Today we're going to try to do an entire chapter. Daniel 8 records the second of four visions that Daniel had. With chapter 7, we move from the first section of Daniel's book to the second section. And now in chapter 8, we're moving from the portion of the book that was written in Aramaic to the latter part of the book, which of course is written in Hebrew. With this change, the focus of the book shifts to the future of the Jewish exile. So that's something we need to keep in mind as we look at chapter 8, is that the focus has now moved to the future of these Jewish exiles who are in Babylon. So this makes sense to me that the shift back to Hebrew is appropriate, since our focus is now back on the Jews and less so on the Gentile nations. As we study this second section of Daniel, we're going to see that this vision left Daniel exhausted and confused and, quite frankly, sick. If we were to look forward to the 27th verse, we would read about this. Daniel was distraught. He was actually bedridden for some time after the vision of chapter 8. This is because this chapter reveals, and he saw in his vision, great difficulties that were ahead for the Jewish peoples. Babylonian captivity would end, but the persecution of the Jews would not. So what we see here is just this cycle of anti-Semitism that is going to continue through the period of the Gentiles until everything is resolved eventually by the Lord. Frequently there are lessons that can be learned in difficult times, and certainly that's the case here. The lesson from chapter 8, if you were to ask me to sum up the chapter, is quite simply this: that no matter how difficult circumstances may become in our lives, God is in control of history, and there will never be a time when God will forsake his people. I think we need to consider just a moment the relationship between chapter 8 and chapters 2 and chapter 7. In chapter 2, God revealed to Nebuchadnezzar how world history would unfold with respect to four Gentile kingdoms. In chapter 7, God revealed to Daniel how world history would unfold during the times of these kingdoms with respect to the Jewish people. So you see that shift there. Then in chapter 8, God is going to focus our attention on two of those four Gentile empires, the four empires that were described in chapter 2 and chapter 7. So the focus of chapter 8 is specifically on the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire. Rather than giving us a broad sketch of end-time events like we saw in chapter 7, this vision is going to focus on part of what was revealed there, the second and third Gentile kingdoms. There definitely are similarities in these chapters, since both the Jews and the Gentiles will live through the same time period. So the first part of the book focused on Gentiles, the second part of the book focuses on the Jewish exiles, and yet Jews and Gentiles live through this period called the times of the Gentiles. So there are similarities there, but there is a difference in emphasis. The Gentile kingdoms, though powerful, are going to be judged. That's one of the lessons from Daniel. The Jews, though, living under divine discipline, they're in captivity in Babylon, they'll be restored in accordance with the promises that God made in his covenants with Abraham and with David. God never forsakes his people, and he's always true to his word. So even though difficult times are ahead for the Jews, God will demonstrate his faithfulness to them over and over throughout the course of history. So, turn, if you will, to Daniel chapter 8. We're going to read the first two verses. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, to Daniel, subsequent to the one that had appeared to me previously. I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking that I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. And I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. This gives us the general setting and the time frame for the second vision. The vision came in the third year of King Belshazzar. I should remind us all that chapters 7 and 8 are not in chronological order in the book of Daniel. The events of chapters 7 and 8, or the last lesson and today's lesson, occur before the events of chapters 5 and 6. So the time frame of chapter 8 puts this vision of Daniel at 551 B.C., This is 12 years prior to the fall of the Chaldean Empire that was recorded in chapter 5. And it is 2 years after Daniel's first vision that was given in Daniel chapter 7. That's the time frame. The setting of the chapter is in a city called Susa, which is actually the Greek spelling of a city properly named Shushan. So the actual name of this city is Shushan. It comes to us as Susa through Greek. Daniel would be about 70 years old. He might be a year or two older when the vision of chapter 8 took place. And I mention this because it raises the question of whether Daniel was physically in Shushan when he had this vision, or whether he was in Babylon. Verse 2 seems to indicate to me that he was in Babylon, and that part of the experience of the vision is that he envisioned himself in Shushan. Verse 2 says, I was looking, and then the very next phrase says, and while I was looking, I was in the city of Shushan. So it's very likely that he was still in Babylon, probably in the palace. This vision came upon him, perhaps in his home, I don't know. And in the vision, he envisioned himself being in Shushan. This city, Shushan, was actually destroyed in 640 BC, but it was rebuilt by Nabopolassar between 626 and 605 BC. It's mentioned tangentially by the prophet Jeremiah around 596 BC, where he mentions that the province of Elam and its capital city of Shushan had once again become a relatively strong nation. There are suggestions out there that Shushan didn't exist in Daniel's day, and they're unfounded. There's plenty of evidence that the city was in fact destroyed, but it was rebuilt. This is not related to the topic that we're studying today, but just as a matter of ancient trivia, if you're interested, Shushan is the place where the Code of Hammurabi was discovered. That's kind of an interesting little sidelight. It's obvious that Daniel is familiar with the cities, familiar with Shushan, irrespective of how we understand verse 2. He says he's standing by the Canal of Ulai. This was an artificial waterway that was built northeast of the city, and it was designed to connect two rivers. The names of the rivers slip my mind at the moment. But that's where the location is. He's 230 miles east of Babylon. He's about 120 miles north of the Persian Gulf in his vision in this place called Shushan. Let's look at verses 3 and 4. Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long. Some may read high there. I think there are some translations that read high, but mine reads, the horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram charging westward, northward, and southward, and no other beasts could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased, and he magnified himself. Once again, the vision employs the symbol of an animal. In this case, it's a ram. The ram is unusual in that it has, not because it has two horns, but because one of the horns is higher or longer, or verse 4 tells us, than the other. That word that tells us, that's translated longer or higher, has a secondary meaning to it, and that secondary meaning is that it can mean exalted. So we're to understand that certainly physically one horn was longer than the other, but we should keep in mind when we think about the horns that this idea that whatever is represented by these horns, one of the things represented is exalted over the other. It's also worth noting that the longer horn came up last. This indicates that there's a period of time or a passing of time that's in view. And again, whatever is represented by the horns, our attention should be on the horn that appears last on the scene. We read in verse 4 that this ram was charging westward, northward, southward, and that no beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone able to rescue a victim from the power of this first beast. It seems as though Daniel may have seen in his vision some other beasts. He doesn't mention them. He simply mentions that apparently there were other beasts that were falling prey to this ram. The ram did as he pleased, and the ram magnified himself by the deeds that he performed. Verse 5. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. He came up to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground, and he trampled him to the ground, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself greatly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So here Daniel mentions a second animal. This animal is a male goat. It is an adversary of the ram, and like the ram, it has an unusual characteristic in that it has this prominent horn between his eyes. The goat moves from west to east. He comes rapidly. This is what is meant by this idea of his movement being without feet touching the ground. He moves very rapidly. But it's important to note that this trait about this goat, it has this conspicuous horn on its head between its eyes. The goat confronted the ram as he rushed the ram, and the text says he did this in his mighty wrath. Verses 6 and 7 both emphasize the anger and the rage that the goat felt toward the ram. Apparently, this battle ended quite quickly. The goat struck the ram. The ram was unable to defend itself against the wrath of the goat. And to make it worse, there were no allies to assist the ram in fending off the goat. Following this victory over the ram, the goat made himself great exceedingly, the text says. It says he exalted himself because of the deed that he had done in defeating the ram. It's worth noting that this word magnified himself and made himself great is used both of the ram and it's used of the goat. It's used of the ram in verse 4. The ram exalted himself. And then it's used of the goat in verse 8, but with the difference that in verse 8 the word exceedingly is added to the sentence. So this modification seems to indicate, or maybe Daniel's way of saying that as great and mighty as the ram was in his day, the goat's power and strength exceeded the ram's at any point in time. The ram was never as powerful as the goat. Whatever the goat represents will be more powerful than anything the world will have seen up to this point. I want you to also notice the timing in the latter part of verse 8. It says that as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. The thrill of victory for this large horn was short-lived. So we have this large horn, and it's broken at the peak of its power. And it was replaced not by another large horn, but by four other horns, each pointed toward the four winds. When the Bible speaks of the four winds here, it's speaking of the four directions of the compass. Verse 9. Out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful. Your Bible may add the word land there, beautiful land. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. The actual Hebrew phrase there isn't commander, but prince. So it's the word tsar, which is the word for prince. So if we read it that way, this horn even magnified itself to be equal with the prince of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him. Him, that's a key to understanding who this prince of the host is. He's the one who receives the Jewish sacrifice. He's God. And he removed the place, he defiled the place of his sanctuary and threw it down. So once again, we're talking here about God's sacrifices, God's sanctuary, and whoever this horn is that's come into the picture here was antagonistic and was opposing Israel's God. Verse 12. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will, and it will prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?" And then we get the answer from the other holy one. These are angels. He said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored." So we have this goat. It has a large horn. It's a very violent creature. At the height of its power, the single large horn is broken, and the horn is replaced by four other horns. Then out of one of those four comes this small horn, which we've just read about, which is persecuting certainly the Jewish people. This small horn grows large. It even extends up to the host of heaven, which is a euphemism or a figure of speech for the people of God. And it causes some of the stars to fall to the earth, again, a euphemism for people, after which he then tramples them down. So as it grew in stature and power, it magnified itself, and it considered itself equal to the prince of the host, which we've determined to be God. As such, this horn removed the regular sacrifice from God, and he destroyed the sanctuary of the prince. It says that the host was given over to the horn because of transgressions. We know that Israel is under divine discipline. That's why they're in captivity in Babylon. And that's what this is referring to. The host is given over to the horn because of transgressions. Now, the Babylonian captivity will end, but so will the sin of Israel, and God will continue to have to discipline his people. So the host is given over because of transgression to the horn. Sacrilege is allowed, and it says that truth is flung to the ground, and what is false is allowed to prosper. Hidden rather plainly in sight here is the age-old problem of evil. You begin to see why Daniel was weak and sick and confused at the end of the vision. And he overhears an angel ask a question. He says, how long will what was seen in the vision apply to the regular sacrifice, and how long will the horror continue so that the holy place is trampled down? And the answer is given in verse 13, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, and then there will be restoration. So let's take a minute. Let me try to put this all together, because we're about to get into the interpretive part of the chapter, and so far this has been quite cryptic. So we're going to take just a moment. Daniel sees a ram that has two horns, one of which is longer than the other. Then he sees a goat come out of the west and attack the ram. The goat has one horn that's prominent, and with that horn the goat attacks and defeats the ram. However, when that horn is at its greatest point of strength and power, that single horn is broken and replaced by four other horns that are associated with the four winds. Out of these four horns, then, another small horn appears and grows in size and stature, and this horn moves south and east and toward Canaan. This horn grew up to the host of heaven, causing some of the stars or holy people to fall to the earth, and it is exalted. It exalts itself and affects the regular sacrifices of the temple, and it tears down the sanctuary of the prince of the host. This is all allowed to take place because of transgression, and the host is given over to the horn. As the horn continues to prosper, truth is flung to the ground, and we can presume it's replaced by what is false. Daniel is disturbed by the vision. The angel then asks, how long will these things last? And the answer is given, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then there will be restoration. So this ends the first section of this chapter and the description of the vision. This will move us into the second section, which is going to be the interpretation of this, because I know this is extremely cryptic when you read through this. I suspect a lot of people start reading this chapter and they get to about verse 4 and they just stop, because it's like, what does this mean? But we're about to find out. Verse 15. And it came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision that I sought to understand it, and behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Ulai, that's that canal, and he called out and he said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he, Gabriel, came near to where I was standing, and when he came I was frightened, and I fell on my face. But he said to me, son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. If we're looking for parallels in Daniel's book, these would be the parallels. The ram of chapter 8 parallels the breast and arms of silver in chapter 2 and the bear of chapter 7. The goat parallels the belly and thighs of bronze of chapter 2 and the leopard of chapter 7. And the third parallel is this, that as with the dream in chapter 2 and the vision in chapter 7, the first half of the chapter describes the facts at hand, or the dream or the vision, and then the latter half of the chapter gives the interpretation. And both chapter 7 and here in chapter 8, there is a heavenly messenger, I would say an angel, who interprets the dream for Daniel. Daniel was seeking to understand what he had seen, and he's perplexed. We're not told that he prayed for an explanation, but the Lord knew that he didn't understand what he was seeing, and so he sends Gabriel to explain to him what this vision means. We read that Daniel sought to understand it, and he uses an interesting noun there. It's the word bina. And he's looking for a special kind of understanding. This is what he's seeking. He's looking for an understanding or an explanation that goes beyond just the gathering of data. He wants to know how to use this information that he is seeing and possessing. It's very possible to hear, it's very possible to see without perceiving what the significance is. If we were to look back in Deuteronomy 32, Moses encouraged the Israelites to consider diligently their own history. He encouraged them to ask their fathers about the generations that came before them. Asaph also struggled with this type of understanding. He, too, was perplexed when he viewed the relative relationship between the wicked and the righteous. When Asaph looked at society, he said, "Sometimes the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer." And he wrote about this in Psalm 73. We studied that psalm some time back, and Asaph concluded that his failure to understand ended. This failure to understand about how the righteous can suffer while the wicked prosper, this understanding came to make sense when he entered the sanctuary of God. He writes in Psalm 73, then he says, "I perceived their end." That's our word. That's the word that occurs in the Daniel passage, bina. "I perceived their end." When he weighed the temporary nature of life against eternity, then he understood how God can allow the wicked to prosper while the people of God suffer. David wrote about this in Psalm 30. He wrote these words, "While his anger is but for a moment, his favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may last for the night, but a shout of joy comes in the morning." This is the kind of understanding Daniel sought from God. And wasn't just interested in being able to repeat these images. He wanted to understand in a spiritual context what God was trying to teach him from this vision. I suspect that he began searching for parallels in his prior vision of 2 years before, the vision that's in chapter 7, hoping that there would be clues there. Whatever progress he was making, apparently it wasn't good enough, because the Lord sends a messenger to explain to Daniel what he could not discern for himself. Verse 15 reads that there was one who looked like a man. One who looked like a man was standing before me. So here and then in the next verse, there are two people. There are two persons. One who's named Gabriel in verse 16, and then one in verse 15 that's simply identified as this one. Gabriel, we know from other scriptures, is an angel. And then there is this one in chapter 8, verse 15, the one who looked like a man. I believe the one who looked like a man was a manifestation of God himself appearing as a theophany to Daniel. And I believe this for two reasons. First, we know that in other scriptures, there are occasions when God manifests himself this way to people. He appeared as a man to Abraham in Genesis 17, and he appeared as a man to Jacob in Genesis chapter 32. I think God made himself known in this way, that is, as a man, to prepare Israel for the incarnation, because the most perfect revelation of God's person is that he came as a man and he dwelled among us as a man. So we shouldn't be surprised that God would preface his first advent with this type of a manifestation of himself. The second reason I think this one is God himself is he who orders Gabriel to interpret the vision in verse 16. I really can't imagine anyone other than God who would presume to order Gabriel to do anything. In addition to that, it says it was one who looked like a man. The word that's used for man there in the phrase, the one who looked like a man, is the word gever. Gever is not the common word for man in the Old Testament. It's not unheard of to use this word to refer to a human being, but the word itself comes from a verb that means to be a hero, to be strong, to be mighty. It speaks not of man in his weakness, not of man in his failings, but man in his strength, man as he might have been before the fall. This is a man who is a mighty one. This one addresses the angel Gabriel, whose name, by the way, is derived from the word Geber. I wrote it up here. If you look at the second Hebrew word on the left, that second word is Geber, and then right below it is Gevurael, and you can see the first three consonants of Gabriel's name are the same three consonants of the word Geber. So it's interesting how those two words are used together in this section of Daniel. So Gabriel obeys God's command. He comes near, he approaches Daniel, and Daniel is terrified when he comes near, which is not an uncommon thing when human beings are in the presence of the supernatural. If you think about the scriptures, when the angel announced to the shepherds that Messiah was born in Bethlehem, the shepherds were afraid. Mary was afraid of Gabriel. So was Zacharias in Luke chapter 1. So a common refrain of angels in the scriptures is, do not fear. He's having a very natural reaction here to the presence of this supernatural being. Look at verse 18. Now while he, Gabriel, was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, and he touched me and made me stand upright. He said, behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. So we have here an identification. We also have an indication here that, as we've spoken before, these visions were not the same thing that we have when we go to bed at night and dream about something. The word that's used here of Daniel, it says that the angel came near and I fell into a deep sleep. It's the word tardama. It's that same word that's used in Genesis 2:21 for the deep sleep that God brought upon Adam before he took his rib. It's a very deep sleep that God caused to fall on Daniel. It's a supernatural state that is common in the Old Testament within the context of theophanies or manifestations of God. There are three phrases that we need to think about. He says, this relates to the final period of indignation in verse 19. Also in 19 he says, and the appointed time of the end. And then if you recall from verse 17, the phrase, the time of the end. So we have to ask ourselves, what time is in view here? There are two ways that you can look at prophecy, and the interpreter has to make a decision about which way he's going to approach this. We need to look at the events of prophecy and see if they're consistent theologically with the rest of the Bible, and also if they fit the facts of history. So there's a term we could probably learn. I wrote it up at the top on the right there. It's the term preterism. One who holds this view is called a preterist. This is a view that treats prophecy as something that's already happened. There are a couple of flavors of preterism, if you will. There's full preterism, which treats all prophecy as having already been fulfilled. And then there are partial preterists who say that most prophecy has already been fulfilled. The way a preterist practically applies their interpretive method is that Daniel's prophecies would refer, in the preterist's mind, to events that took place in the 2nd century B.C., and prophecies of the New Testament book of Revelation would be events that took place in the 1st century A.D. Now, I've said from the start of this study that there are some of Daniel's prophecies that were future when he made them, which have indeed been fulfilled. An obvious example of this is in the 4th chapter, the temporary insanity of King Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel predicted that this would happen to the king, and in fact it did happen during the life of Daniel. Daniel was also able to predict the fall of the Chaldean Empire, and he was alive when the Persians came in and took the empire. Recognizing that Daniel's prophecies are unfolding over time doesn't qualify us as preterists. Preterists explain everything from the second advent to the resurrection of the dead to the final judgment as completely fulfilled in such events as the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD and the transfiguration of Christ. So we shouldn't confuse the unfolding of prophecy over time with preterism because they're not the same thing. So what about these phrases? How do we interpret them? The final period of indignation and the appointed time of the end and the time of the end. These refer, I believe, to the vision itself and are contextualized by the vision. The vision relates primarily to events that were future to Daniel but are historical to us. But they, at the same time, even though they are historical to us, they prefigure and foreshadow the end of our age. So there's this predictive element to the visions that's still future, and I'm going to try to explain this as we go through the next few verses. Verse 20 identifies the first animal. It tells us that the ram is the Medo-Persian Empire. The text says that the ram which you saw with the two horns represent the kings of Media and Persia. And remember, the kings and the kingdoms that they rule are treated as one and the same in the language of Daniel. If you recall back in verses 3 and 4, the ram has two horns, one longer than the other, and the longer one coming up last. As we've seen already in chapters 2 and 7, the two horns represent the combined kingdoms of the Medo-Persian Empire, the Medes and the Persians. In the beginning, the Medes were stronger. They had dominion over the Persians, but very quickly the Persians were able to defeat the Medes, and the Medes faded into the background of history, and the Persians, in fact, became the dominant force. So if you look even 40 years past the time that Daniel wrote this, to in both biblical references in the book of Esther, for example, and in extra-biblical literature, you'll never find reference to the Medo-Persian Empire. It's always the Persians and the Medes, with the Persians getting top billing. So this happens at a time when the Persians are gaining dominance over the Medes. And that's what's represented by the two horns, the longer horn, of course, being Persia. The ram was an appropriate representation of the Persian Empire. If you look forward to the 4th century AD, the historian Ammianus Marcellinus, he wrote about a Persian king who bore the head of a ram as he stood at the head of his army. He wrote a book, or actually a series of books, a work you might call it, called Roman Antiquities. And in book 19, Marcellinus, who was himself a Roman soldier, recounts an attack by the Persians against the Roman city of Amida in 359 AD. And he writes that the tradition of the ram's head as a being a symbol of Persia was alive and well even that far in the future. This is what he wrote. He wrote, "The king," speaking of the Persian king, "rejoicing in the wretched imprisonment of our men and anticipating like successes, set forth from there and slowly advancing came to Amida on the third day. And when the first gleam of dawn appeared, everything, so far as the eye could see, shone with the glittering of arms, and mail-clad cavalry filled the hill and dale. The king himself mounted upon a charger, and overtopping the others, rode before the whole army, wearing in place of a diadem, a gold image of a ram's head set with precious stones." So this idea that the ram represented Persia is something that would have been very evident to the people historically. Verse 21, "The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between its eyes is the first king of Greece. The broken horn and the four horns that rose up in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power." So the next identification Gabriel gives is this shaggy goat that's called a he-goat or a male goat in verse 5. This goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the one horn in the middle of its head represents the first king of Greece, Alexander the Great. In Daniel's first vision in chapter 7, we have four beasts arising out of the sea, and beyond the normal evils that empires bring on their enemies and sometimes even on their citizens, out of the fourth empire of Rome, we had a great monster who arose, who is the Antichrist. This we studied in chapter 7. The second vision is different. In the second vision, Daniel warns the Israelites that another tyrant is going to come. You have to remember, Daniel's primary purpose here is to inform the Jewish exiles of what's to come in their future and what's to happen in the future of their descendants. So he's warning them that another beast, not the beast of chapter 7, but another beast is coming, and this other beast has a name. His name is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. I'll talk about him in a minute. In his description of the goat's exploits, Daniel says the goat came from the west, and of course Greece is located west of Persia, and the goat had a prominent horn between his eyes. That prominent horn was Alexander the Great. He was maybe the best military leader who's ever lived. In 334 BC, Alexander the Great invaded Asia Minor. He was 22 years old at the time, and he carried in his pocket into battle a copy of Homer's Iliad, which tells you something about how he viewed his role. He set out with a spirit of revenge, to revenge against King Xerxes had done to Greece 150 years earlier. Xerxes had attacked Athens, it had burned it to the ground, and Alexander intended to do the same thing to the Persians. He hated them. Alexander won battle after battle. He took Ecbatana, he took Shushan, he took Persepolis. He continued his exploits through Afghanistan. He made it all the way to India. And then something very interesting happened. In June of 323 BC, Alexander the Great died at age 32. Think about that. All the things he accomplished, he died at age 32. His death fulfilled the prophecy. As soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. Verse 8. After his death, his generals fought over his kingdom. You'll read accounts where, as he was dying, he called in his generals and he made certain suggestions to them. But the fact is, they were greedy. And so for the next 20 years after his death, there were fighting and battles that went on for dominance. What eventually happened was there were four generals who emerged with powerful enough to hold authority. A general named Cassander, who took Macedonia and Greece. Lysimachus, who ruled Thrace and a lot of Asia Minor. Ptolemy. If you go to Egypt, you'll see all sorts of shrines to the Ptolemaic kings there. Ptolemy took Egypt, and Seleucus ruled Syria and the Eastern Empire. This fulfills the prophecy both of verse 8 and verse 22. There came up four horns toward the four winds. So it's interesting how clearly this fits with the historical facts. Let's look at verse 23. In the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. And he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. And through his shrewdness, he'll cause deceit to succeed by his influence. And he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. He'll even oppose the prince of princes, and he will be broken without human agency. The vision of the evening and morning, which has been told, is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. If we were to backtrack to verse 9, and then look specifically at verses 23 through 25, we would read about this small horn who grew out of one of them. One of them refers to the four generals, the four horns. That's exactly what happened historically. So let me clarify something, because it's easy to get confused here. This horn that we see in chapter 8, verses 9 and 22 through 23, is not the same horn we studied in chapter 7. That's extremely important to understand. In Daniel 7, verse 8, a small horn arose out of the fourth empire, out of the revived Roman Empire during the tribulation. And he ruled that kingdom and eventually rules the world until he's destroyed by the Lord at the second advent. The horn of chapter 7 is the Antichrist. The horn of chapter 8 is this historical figure, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. He's a Greek, he's not a Roman. He arises from the third kingdom, not from the fourth kingdom, and he arises after the death of Alexander. The horn of chapter 7 will arise in the future. The horn of chapter 8 is historical and arose during the Hellenistic monarchy of these four generals after the death of Alexander the Great. So let's try to put Antiochus Epiphanes in a context. Antiochus the Fourth was the eighth ruler of the domain of Seleucus. Seleucus is one of the four generals, right? Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. So he is a Seleucid general. He is the eighth ruler of the domain of Seleucus, and recall that this is growing out of Alexander's empire after Alexander's death. The domain of Seleucus included Syria and the Eastern Empire, which included Palestine. His title, Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth is who he is, then he has a title, Epiphanes, comes from an inscription he had minted on the coins of the realm. On the coins that were used, he had his image, and next to his image, right beneath it, was the phrase Theos Epiphanes, which means God made manifest. So he was fairly prideful. That's where his name comes from. So let me try to help with a little bit of chronology. I'll make this real simple. Alexander the Great died in 323 BC. One of the four generals who followed Alexander was Seleucus. Seleucus died in 281 BC, 42 years after the death of Alexander. Antiochus IV Epiphanes was born in 215 BC and died in 164 BC, some 159 years after Alexander's death and 117 years after the death of Seleucus. And he's the eighth ruler of the Seleucus-Seleucian domain. So there have been seven others fall during that 117 years. Verse 23 describes Antiochus as insolent and skilled in intrigue. He was cruel. He was a man of high ambition. If he could gain influence and power through flattery, he would do it. If flattery didn't work, murder was always an option. Antiochus had a problem. And this is a problem that really sets the stage for a lot of things that happen in the New Testament. He had a problem. He was the ruler over a domain made up of an extremely diverse population. The people had different customs. They spoke different languages, and they had different religions. That's a problem. It makes ruling that domain very difficult. So among his biggest problems are, guess what? The Jews. So he came up with a strategy to solve his diversity problem. We live in an age where we try to create diversity. He's trying to reduce it because diversity was making his empire impossible to manage. So he has this problem. So he comes up with this strategy, and the strategy is designed to solve his diversity problem, and the strategy is he wants to Hellenize the entire realm. What Hellenization means is make everything like Greek. Okay? He's going to turn everything into Greek. This means he would impose the Greek culture. It means he would impose the Greek language. And it means that he would impose Greek religion on all people, including the Jews. Now, most of these pagans always had room in their pagan religions for another god. So he didn't have that problem with the majority of the population, except for the Jews, where incorporating another god into their religion was absolutely impossible. So the Jews become a problem. Now, you can go to Israel today, and you can still see evidence there of Seleucid Hellenization that's apparent in the north. If you go to near the foot of Mount Hermon in the Golan Heights, near a city called Caesarea Philippi, and you go there in the north, there is a shrine erected to the Greek god Pan. Pan was a deity, interestingly enough, with the feet of a goat. So we have the ram associated with the Persians, we have the goat associated with the Greek. You can go there, you can see this thing for yourself even today. So this is the plan that he has. He's going to import everything Greek, he's going to indoctrinate the people, he's going to reduce the diversity of the kingdom in order to make it easy to govern. So if you've ever wondered why everyone in Palestine knew how to speak Greek, and why it was important to translate the Old Testament into Greek, the Septuagint, it has to do with the Hellenization that came after Alexander the Great, and particularly through Antiochus Epiphanes. There were some Jews who went along with this conformed Hellenization, but a lot of them resisted, and this was a problem. Their resistance caused Antiochus to try to stamp out Judaism completely. And to combat these faithful Jews who were holding out against his Hellenization strategy, he imposed a whole body of new laws that were contrary to the religious life of Israel. If you wonder, where do you get primary sources for this period of Jewish history? Well, one thing you can do is you can go to the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. They're part of a group of documents known as the Apocrypha. They're non-canonical books, but they do appear in the Catholic Bible. So I realized I didn't have a copy of the Maccabean document, so I called Wendell. He had given his away. So I found myself last week in a Catholic bookstore. So I have here the Holy Bible Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition. And the reason I have it is that it includes the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees and some other apocryphal book. What I've just told you is that Antiochus Epiphanes, because of the holdout by these faithful Jews, decides he's going to stamp out Judaism completely. So let me read you a few verses here from 1st Maccabees. Chapter 1, the first part of the chapter gives the transition from Alexander to the Hellenistic monarchy and Antiochus, so our context is appropriate here. This is going to refer to Antiochus as the king. Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people. That's that plan to Hellenize. He didn't want all the diversity. The kingdom should be one people, and each should give up his own customs. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many, even from Israel, gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and feasts, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they should forget the law and change all the ordinances. And whosoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. The king is Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. No wonder Daniel felt responsible to warn the Jews of what was coming. So Antiochus made it a crime to possess a copy of the Hebrew Scriptures. He made circumcision illegal. He declared it a crime to observe the Sabbath. With respect to burnt offerings and drink offerings, they were outlawed. In fact, he ordered the Jews to profane the sanctuary and to profane their feast days. He ordered the priests to profane themselves, to burn the flesh of swine on the Jewish altar, an unclean animal, obviously. The Jews were ordered to forget the law of Moses, and if any defied the order of Antiochus, the penalty was death. Well, a lot of the Jews folded. Many of them folded under the pressure, but others went into hiding, and they refused to betray what they knew was right. So he steps up his solution to the next level. We read on in 1 Maccabees, many of the people, everyone who forsook the law, joined them, and they did evil in the land. They drove Israel into hiding in every place of refuge that they had. On the 15th day of Kislev, in the 145th year, they erected a desolating sacrilege upon the altar of burnt offerings. They also built altars in the surrounding cities of Judah and burned incense at the doors of the houses and in the streets. The books of the law which they found, they tore to pieces and burned with fire. Where the book of the covenant was found in the possession of anyone, or if anyone adhered to the law, the decree of the king condemned him to death. They kept using violence against Israel, against those found month after month in the cities. And on the 25th day of the month, they offered sacrifice on the altar, which was upon the altar of burnt offering. According to the decree, they put to death the women who had their children circumcised and their families, and those who circumcised them, and they hung the infants from their mothers' necks. That's Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. Verse 12 of chapter 8 states that this horn, Antiochus, will fling the truth to the ground. That's the prophecy. This is consistent with the account of 1 Maccabees. The books of the law, which they found, they tore to pieces and they burned with fire. Not only did he do these things, but he set up an altar to Zeus in the Jewish temple. He slaughtered pigs on the altar and he offered them upon the altar to Zeus. This is what is called later in Daniel's book and in the New Testament, the abomination of desolation. I think you've got a pretty good picture now of who Antiochus IV Epiphanes was. He was a merciless persecutor of the Jews, an anti-Semite. Now there's an interpretive element that I need to try to explain. Even though Antiochus comes out of the third kingdom, not the fourth, even though the little horn of chapter 7 and the little horn of chapter 8 are different people, one being Antiochus, the other being the Antichrist, Antiochus foreshadows the Antichrist. Antiochus is what we call a type, to which the antitype is the Antichrist. Typology is an interpretive tool whereby the element that we are focused on in the Old Testament is seen to prefigure or typify in some way a corresponding element in the New Testament. King David, he's not the Messiah, but he typifies Messiah's kingship. Melchizedek is not the Messiah, but he typifies Messiah's priesthood. Paul uses the desert wanderings of Israel to typify the Christian life in 1 Corinthians. And in Galatians, he uses Sarah and Hagar to contrast the slavery under the law with the freedom that we have by grace under the new covenant. We have to, as we study this little horn in chapter 8, we have to understand that the little horn in chapter 8 and the little horn in chapter 7 have to kind of be viewed in this way. Antiochus, by his actions and his deeds and his abominations in the 2nd century B.C., typifies the actions and deeds and abominations that will be done by the Antichrist in the Great Tribulation. One of these personages is historical, Antiochus. The other is yet future, the Antichrist. So this is how we have to view this particular text. So let's look back to the text. Verse 24 describes the power of this king, of Antiochus. As Daniel looks forward to the time of the third empire, keep in mind, Daniel at this time, third year of Belshazzar, he's still in the Chaldean Empire. He is 12 years before the fall of the Chaldean Empire. He's looking forward to the third empire, Greece. He says Antiochus will be mighty, but he will not be mighty by his own power. That's an interesting phrase. The text says, but not by his own power. Antiochus will be ruthless and powerful, but his power will pale compared to the one that he prefigures. We know from Revelation chapter 13, verse 2, it affirms that it will be Satan who empowers the Antichrist, but I think we would be fools not to think that Satan is given at least some limited power, limited opportunity now to work through world leaders. I can say of Antiochus with very little doubt that he was driven and empowered by Satan. I think few would doubt the same of Hitler, of Pol Pot, of Mao, and many other tyrants the world has had the misfortune to experience. But in verse 25, we begin to see how Antiochus, as bad as he was, prefigures another. The king described here confronts the prince of princes. In verse 11, the horn is seen magnifying itself to a place equal with the prince of the host. And then here in this latter verse, the prince of princes. I think it's a divine title. It's made clear that the horn removes the regular sacrifice from him, that is from God, the logical antecedent being the prince of the host, and he casts down his sanctuary. But even if this falls short of verse 25, when the horn opposes the prince of princes, and which is a title in the same vein as King of Kings or Lord of Lords, the parallel between verse 25 and 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4 is striking. In the New Testament passage, the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, opposes and exalts himself above God, even seating himself in the temple and displaying himself as God. The language describing Antichrist is strikingly similar to the language of Daniel 8, verse 25, and seems to go beyond anything Antiochus as a mere man would be able to accomplish. Back in 14, period of time is mentioned, 2300 evenings and mornings. This was the answer to a question raised by an angel. The angel said, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifices apply so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled? It's a logical question that should be asked. Leon Wood, who's a pretty good commentator on Daniel, provides a paraphrase. I thought I would read what he said. It's pretty short. He says, this is his paraphrase of the verse. The vision which concerns the period of time of 2300 days, when Antiochus will oppress the Jews, this period culminating the history depicted in the first part of the vision and foreshadowing the future time of oppression of Antichrist is the central feature of this vision. So these 2300 days represent the period of time that Antiochus oppressed the Jews. It's an historical reference. We don't have enough historical data to provide an exact to the day calculation, but we can do some approximations. Let's begin with the ending point. When does the 2300 days end? Well, the ending point is the restoration of the temple that was made impure by Antiochus Epiphanes. The text says that at the end of 2300 days, then it'll be restored. So the end time, the end of the 2300 days is the restoration of the temple. And this restoration occurred under Judas Maccabeus on December 25th, 165 BC. So that's our start point from which we're going to count backwards. Antiochus pollutes the temple, offers the swine and pigs on the altar, does all these things that we read about, and then on December 25th, 165 BC, Judas Maccabeus cleanses the temple. So that is the end of the 2300 days of oppression. If we count back from then, 2300 days, we arrive at September 6th, 171 BC, as the start point for the 2300 days. What is going on here is this. We do know that the atrocities against the Jews under Antiochus began in 170 BC. We don't know exactly what day it was, and we don't know exactly what the event was that marked the beginning of this persecution. But we know it was 171 BC, and we know that 2300 days from a date in that year was the cleansing of the temple by Judas Maccabeus. So this turns out to be not at all inconsistent with what's known, the history of the Jewish people, from everything that we can look at and see. Verse 27. This is an ordeal that Daniel encountered here. He emerged from his vision sick, confused. He was able to be restored and resume his duties at the palace after some rest. Another commentator, Stephen Miller, speculated that perhaps Daniel still served in some capacity in the court of Belshazzar, but at the pleasure of Nabonidus, the father of Belshazzar, rather than Belshazzar himself. That seems very reasonable to me. Daniel is introduced by the mother of Belshazzar, Nitocris, in chapter 5, the night of the handwriting on the wall incident, as if Belshazzar didn't know who Daniel was, and yet he was active in the court. Whatever the relationship may have been with the court of Belshazzar, he emerged from this experience very confused, and I think it's probably safe to say he's not the last person to ever be confused by Daniel chapter 8. The message of Daniel's second vision concerns a time in the distant future from Daniel's day, but a time in the distant past from our day. Yet there are truths that apply to all times. Here are a few of them. God's omniscience is apparent in this chapter, for he knows the future and he's able to reveal it. God's sovereignty also is set forth as he controls all the details of history, setting up kings and kingdoms and bringing rulers to their knees when he sees fit to do so. We also see here God's perfect justice, for though Antiochus opposed the great prince, he was brought down and broken. The text says without human agency, a clear declaration that the ever-perplexing problem of evil will be resolved. Now, I didn't mention this, but it says that this king is destroyed without human agency. It literally says in the Hebrew, without a human hand. And we know that Antiochus wasn't killed in battle, but he died of a mental disorder. We also see in Daniel chapter 8 that God has a plan for the world. And it's a plan that's being played out now, and it will come to proper conclusion in a manner that will resolve the problem of evil in the world and will bring glory to the name of the Lord. When we study Antiochus and examine the things that he did, there are many typological applications to the Antichrist. Antiochus is not the Antichrist, but he's like the Antichrist in many ways. Chapter 8, verse 9, Antiochus and the Antichrist in chapter 7, verse 8 are both represented by the symbol of a small horn that started out small but grew large in influence and power. It's a horn that's designed to inflict harm on an enemy. And both Antiochus and Antichrist inflict harm on God's people. Antiochus was insolent and he was skilled and intrigued. Antichrist, described as having the eyes of a man. It suggests the ability to persuade and suggest ideas and policies and strategies that will seem good to the world, but are in fact opposed to the will of God. Antiochus possessed great power, and he destroyed thousands of Jewish believers. Antichrist will have even greater power, and he will destroy more believers than Antiochus. Antiochus was not killed by human hands. Antichrist will meet his doom at the hand of God. In this chapter, history and eschatology blend together to tell a very unique story. Even in the 21st century, history is telling the story of our future. And there's an interesting interplay between difficulty and trial and blessing. Weeping indeed may last for the night, but because we serve a benevolent and gracious God, a shout of joy is sure to come in the morning. And that's the message of chapter 8.